It's hard to ignore that childhood has changed in a lot of ways. And one of the most striking reasons is the role technology is playing in it. From the NPR Network and KPBS, this is Screen Time, a podcast featuring conversations about technology and kids in today's digital age. Listen to Screen Time wherever you get your podcasts. Hey there, San Diego. It's time for KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. An investigation uncovered fraud at San Diego Stadiums and a charity that didn't exist. Now that reporting has led to the guilty pleas of two men behind the scam. Then, the dwindling Colorado River provides precious water for many U.S. states, as well as Mexico. Why a group of Baja farmers are fighting for compensation for that water. Plus, the hosts of the KPBS podcast, Port of Entry, join us to share what they love about living along the border. That's ahead on KPBS Roundtable. Two men behind a charity fraud scheme pled guilty to federal charges this week. The cases involved a scheme to siphon money from concession stands at some of San Diego's most well-known stadiums, including Petco Park, home of the San Diego Padres. Scheme was originally uncovered through reporting from Voice of San Diego, which started covering it back in 2023. Will Huntsbury is an assistant editor and former senior investigative journalist with Voice of San Diego, who began reporting on this over 2 years ago. Will, welcome back to Roundtable.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Great to have you here. We really appreciate your time. I mean, you know, we had you on about 2 years ago talking about this very story. Tell us about the latest news.
Yeah, the latest news is that we learned two men pleaded guilty to wire conspiracy fraud, you know, related to everything we uncovered back in 2023. Their names were Noli Alarde and Martin Rebollo. Prosecutors found that they got $3.5 million from Petco Park from running concession stands and pretending to be a softball charity over 9 years. And then they also got $250,000 from Snapdragon Stadium doing the same thing.
You mentioned this softball charity. It was called Chula Vista Fast Pitch. Break it down. You know, what's the story behind that supposed charity or one-time charity, right?
One-time charity is correct, yes. You know, when we uncovered this story in 2023, it seemed clear right away that it was a criminal enterprise. And, you know, that is the finding that's been backed up now, essentially. But Chula Vista Fast Pitch started as a real softball league. But then in 2014, it stopped being a softball league. And these two guys, Ilarde and Rebollo, they started using it as a front to run concession stands in Petco Park. And for people who don't know, the concession stands in many stadiums, a lot of them are staffed by volunteers. And so a volunteer group, you know, like a softball league, will go in, they'll bring a lot of bodies, and they'll get to keep 10% of the take from their stand. That money's supposed to then go to softball in that case, or whatever your preferred charity is. But in this case, Rebollo and Ilarde were paying people under the table and below minimum wage, $50 a game in a lot of cases. And then they were keeping all the rest of the money for themselves. And so that was the big thing that we busted open in 2023. A lot of follow-up stories. But that is also the bulk of what these criminal charges come from.
Yeah, and that relationship between local charities and stadium concessions, I think that was like a world not many people knew about, right? I mean, did you even know about that when you started?
I had no idea. Yeah, I had no idea that that was how it worked. You know, we got an anonymous tip. You know, I think Voice of San Diego is known for its investigative journalism. And, you know, anybody out there listening, feel free to keep hitting me up with those tips. But, you know, we got an anonymous tip. This was happening. And then I had to kind of learn more about it. And it's like, oh, okay, this is actually common practice across stadiums across the country that these volunteer groups come in and staff. I went to the stadium. I started approaching people who I could see were volunteers because they wear different uniforms than the actual people who are getting paid to work concession stands. And I started going up to the Chula Vista fast pitch stands and saying, like, hey, do you work with one of these charities? What charity are you supporting? And a lot of times I was getting, I think so. Or, what do we support again? Sports? Softball? What is it? And so that was an immediate huge red flag, right? Because if you're a real charity and you've got these volunteers coming out to work for free, it seems most likely you're going to know what you're supporting out there, what charity is you're volunteering for.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, part of your reporting, you also spoke with these two men, Martin and Noli, who just pled guilty. Tell us about that, you know, that story.
Yeah, I did talk to them. You know, I approached Noli at a ballpark eat stand on the main level there at Petco and, told him I was a reporter and asked him what Chula Vista Fast Pitch is, if he runs it. And he immediately kind of threw the other guy under the bus, Martin, and was like, oh, his name's on all the paperwork. He runs it. I'm just a manager. And he like disappeared very quickly. And then Martin, I got him on the phone and that conversation was even stranger. I was like, do you run Chula Vista Fast Pitch? And he was like, no, it's another guy. And I was like, well, who's the other guy? And he's like, well, I don't remember his name. I think I remember his last name. I think it's such and such, you know? And, I kept pushing, asked him if there was, anything shady going on here. He says no. Then he weirdly says, there's another entity called Chula Vista Fast Patch. And I'm like, okay. So I looked that up. Turns out that was a charity briefly. It's something these guys actually did register, but immediately kind of stopped being a charity because they didn't file the right paperwork. So I mean, the shadiness, let's call it, was pretty immediate right away.
So aside from, this criminal cases here that happened this week, what about the stadium operators and have those practices changed or have they, has there been any reforms on that side of it?
Yeah, it's a great question, because we continued to dig into this after we found out about Chula Vista Fast Pitch. It seemed like a whole system that's ripe for exploitation. And so we started talking to concession workers at other places like Chula Vista Amphitheater. And we found two other charities that were paying workers under the table and below minimum wage to do this work, which is not allowed either. So it did, and we talked to a guy who had been a former minor league baseball team owner who had, been part of this system a lot. And he said that the whole thing was like a cesspool, really, that it's just, it's big business. Selling these hot dogs and these beers is big business. And the Padres make a lot of money, and the concession companies that kind of handle it all for them make a lot of money at Petco Park. That's Delaware North. And so, if somebody comes to you and tells you they're a charity and brings the people to staff the stands, there's not a lot of built-in incentive to check up on that necessarily. And that's what Noli and Martin were doing. At one point, they were staffing like a third of the stands at Petco Park. And so I think when you've got somebody bringing in that many people, it's unclear what questions you're asking, but it is very clear that like those people are helping you out. Mm-hmm. And so, after our reporting, Delaware North said they did change their practices, but they wouldn't tell us how. And the Padres kind of said, Delaware North runs our operations. This is not us. You need to talk to Delaware North.
Yeah.
And so it's still a little bit of a black box, like how much this has changed. There was, companies told us they changed it and they're doing better. But we, they haven't showed us all the receipts on that.
So, it's hard to not talk about the story. without talking about your role in it, right? I mean, the prosecutor confirmed how your reporting kind of got the ball rolling on the case. And I'm just wondering, you know, as a journalist, what's your reaction to that? How has that been to process? What do you take from it?
Yeah, you know, it's been really good validation, I think. You know, as I said, when we wrote the initial story, it seemed clear it was a criminal enterprise. It seemed clear that was what we had uncovered. It didn't take a lawyer to figure that out. And so then we knew the FBI was investigating, but we kind of thought maybe the investigation had fizzled out and nothing would come from it. So, you know, that's a little disheartening as an investigative journalist that you uncover this conspiracy that the whole city gets really up in arms about and wants something to be done about. You know, I mean, there are legitimate charities that could have been benefiting from this. So to have it all validated that it was like deeply inappropriate, you know, is huge as a reporter, you know. You know, that's why I got into this whole thing, right? Is to uncover stuff that goes against the public interest. And I think that's what we uncovered here. And now, like, you know, to get this final validation has been amazing.
You know, on Roundtable, we talk with reporters and a lot we talk about their approach to their work and also about just the challenges the journalism industry is facing. You know,
sure.
Seeing like shrinking local news, right, and stuff that we talk about regularly. I mean, how does working on a story like this and seeing its impact change how you view where journalism is and where it needs to go?
Yeah, it's really heartening. It's really humbling to see your work have impact. And I think it shows that we need to be investing in local reporting. You know, there's no national reporter that was going to find this story. That's just not the case. And so, you know, I hope that people who were invested in this story will also be invested in local news and places like KPBS and places like Voice of San Diego and help us continue to do that mission. Because, you know, you go to like, you know, a presidential debate and you see 5 million reporters there, like all covering the same story. And that just does not have the same impact as like high quality local reporters focusing like on a community and with an accountability lens, you know, attempting to hold public officials accountable, attempting to hold institutions accountable and charities accountable. And so that's why I've been at Voice of San Diego so long, I think almost 9 years now, because it gives me the opportunity to have an impact here in my community. And that is very fulfilling.
Okay, so these two men have pled guilty. You know, what's next for the case? What are you still following it? Like, what's coming up?
Yeah, they pleaded guilty. Their sentencing is coming up in the summer. Ilarde will be sentenced in late May, or that's when it's scheduled, and Rebollo later in June. Wire fraud conspiracy, which is what they were both charged with, carries a maximum of 20 years. Basically, I think the shorthand version of what that boils down to is like lying to get money. Now, Rebollo was also charged with other things. He was charged with Social Security fraud because he was receiving disability while he was getting this money. And he was also charged with tax fraud because his name was on all the documents. And he's going to have to pay back $550,000 at least to the IRS. And, you know, we'll certainly be watching that sentencing this summer to see what comes of it. And we'll stay on the stadiums, you know, to see how they respond to it and what they're going to do about it, if anything.
Well, it's, you know, amazing investigation and really just incredible to see the result. Will, congratulations. Will Huntsbury is an assistant editor and former investigative reporter with Voice of San Diego. You can read his stories. We'll have a link to that on our website at kpbs.org. Will, thanks again for taking the time to break this down for us.
Thanks, Andrew.
Coming up, how a fight over Colorado river water is playing out in Mexico. You're listening to KPBS Roundtable. Yeah.
Watch programs on your schedule with the KPBS Plus streaming service. See new episodes of Nature and Nova, latest news from PBS NewsHour and KPBS Evening Edition, local shows like Ken Kramer's About San Diego. Learn more at kpbs.org/kpbsplus.
Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. Our next conversation brings us to the Colorado River. It's the key water source for 7 U.S. states and much of Baja California. But the river is struggling due to overuse and climate change. Over in Mexicali, a group of farmers are protesting. They say the government owes them millions of dollars for conserving some of that water. I'm joined now by two journalists who have collaborated on reporting on this story. Mackenzie Elmer is environment and energy reporter at Voice of San Diego. And Vicente Calderon is also here. He's founder and editor of TijuanaPress.com. Mackenzie, Vicente, welcome back to Roundtable, both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Great to have both of you here. Mackenzie, before jumping into this reporting that you both were working on, I'm wondering if you can just first paint a picture for us, the role the Colorado River plays in our overall water picture.
San Diego would not exist without the Colorado River. We get most of our water, drinking, for commercial, for business, everything. Same as LA. Many large Western states all exist because the Colorado River water is shipped in to help power those economies.
And Vicente, that brings us to Baja and Mexico. What are the biggest challenges Baja is facing when it comes to water?
Well, the problem is that we are seeing a reduction on the allocations from the Colorado River, and we are seeing more demand, especially from the cities like Tijuana or Rosarito, that are growing incrementally every day. So we are seeing that we don't have enough sources of water other than the Colorado River, and we have more demand now.
And how exactly does that water, you know, come from Colorado River, come down to San Diego, but also get its way to Baja? Mackenzie, is that something you can?
Yeah, there's a large aqueduct system built. For San Diego, it runs from the Colorado River to Los Angeles, and then Los Angeles has an aqueduct built south to San Diego, which ends in a reservoir. And for Tijuana, it gets its water also through an aqueduct over the mountains, through Mexicali and, you know, across the border from canals that bring the water down south.
So, you know, your story here focuses on a group of farmers in Mexicali and looking for, you know, compensation for not using some of this water. And it involves an agreement between the U.S. and Mexican governments. Can you tell us more about that, Mackenzie?
Yeah. So most of the Colorado River water, a large portion of it, is used for farming, pretty much kind of in the U.S. and in Mexico. So in order to save water, the United States and Mexico basically have to work with their farmers to agree to not grow crops in order to save water on the Colorado River, which is, you know, facing a really big problem. So,
and Vicente, tell us, you know, more about these farmers and what they've told you about the money they're saying they're still owed here.
Well, the thing is that these farmers agreed to following their lands or to not to farm their lands just because the reduction of the allocations of water coming from the Colorado River. But they were promised by the Mexican government that in exchange for their rights, the given rights from historically as farmers, they will be compensated. And this, since these negotiations between the U.S. and Mexico happened on the highest level, they ended up just receiving, as a third party, so to speak, the money. And they are complaining that there's not enough transparency in the way the Mexican authorities have been distributing or using this money. They are saying that they are invested most of it to some public works, but also since they give up their likelihood of farming in exchange for the reduction of the water allocations, they are now want to see more clearly where the money is going and what happened with the other thousands of dollars or pesos that were promised for them to allow the water to be used for some other purposes.
Yeah, just to add to that, so more context, this is actually like U.S. taxpayer dollars that are funneled to the Mexican government in order to achieve these you know, fallowed lands or to get farmers to not produce crops in order to save water. And that kind of same mechanism is used. That's actually how San Diego gets a lot of its water. San Diego pays a high price to farmers in the Imperial Valley, and in exchange, they get to use the water that those farmers would otherwise have used for their crops. And so what we're talking about here is, and what Vicente and I are trying to figure out, is, you know, there's been these treaties or agreements between Mexico and the United States to get Mexico to, like, reduce its use of the Colorado River, which a lot of U.S. states, especially in the northern portion of the country, Colorado, et cetera, are not agreeing to do. And so a lot of the effort to save the Colorado River or reduce our use is kind of incumbent on places like Mexico. And so we can't really figure out still exactly how much money. We know how much was promised. We know how much it, I think, was paid by the United States, or at least what they have said, but how it's been dispersed and where the rest of the funding is kind of unclear. And maybe Vicente can elaborate on that some more if he wants.
Well, the farmers are telling us that they have agreed voluntarily to this exchange of getting money compensation instead of the use. They understand the situation of the mega drought and the impact of climate change. But the problem is that they have seen no clarity on the way this money has been spent. You have to keep in mind that this is just a fraction of the huge problem of the water crisis we are facing at this side of the border. The Colorado River runs naturally, and about 80% of the allocation gets to Mexicali, for thanks to the farmers that are willing to, other group of farmers are willing to see their rights. We have water in Tijuana and in Rosarito. So when even when this is a small group of about 1,200 farmers, mainly all citizens who have been farming the land for several years, this has a big impact, the lack of clarity in the way they are negotiating with the Mexican government and the U.S. government.
And, you know, this group of protesting farmers, they've been at odds with the Mexican government for many years at this point, right, Vicente? Can you tell us more about that relationship?
Well, since they are been asking this to demonstrate that the money has been spent according to what they were promised, they have been taking over the offices of CONAGUA, the main water commission or main water authority in Mexico. And for the third time last month, they took over the offices. They agreed to see if, according to what they are told us, were told by the U.S. agencies, they're going to be able to get more money from the U.S. So these people, 40% of these farmers that are protesting are seniors, according to what this group has told us, are waiting to see if there's an amicable way to resolve this problem. Otherwise, they're promising that they're going to go and take over again the CONAGUA offices. Just keep in mind that even when this is a small group, the whole agricultural groups in Mexicali are supporting them in different levels, because they are seeing that their long history, the water acquired water rights are on jeopardy due to this situation of the mega drought and the new laws that Mexico is taking full control, Mexican government is taking full control of the use of water in the country.
Mackenzie. Yeah, just to expand on what Vicente just said, our first story we wrote about this issue, the farmers were actually blockading the produce routes to the United States with their trucks. And it was actually over a different problem, much also complex, but Mexico, President Sheinbaum's administration made sweeping changes to the water laws in Mexico and basically nationalized all of the water resources there. And the impact of that in Mexicali was, you know, as President Sheinbaum had said, you know, we're trying to stamp out these black market water markets. And that's what the government essentially considered the trade between Mexicali farmers who had these sort of concessions from the government to use water and sell it to Tijuana. They consider that like a black market. So we've kind of seen we're sort of tracking this pressure from the federal government on this these agreements that have existed for a while. Yes, it is a market. It's a trade between the cities and the farmers. But it seems like the Mexican government is trying to just basically claw back that water and control over it. And I think part of this is because of mounting pressure from President Trump, who has stepped in on some of these water disputes between Mexico and the United States. And so that's a whole other conversation potentially for another day.
But yes.
I wanted to turn a little bit to your collaboration in this. Obviously, water, you mentioned, starts up the Colorado River and it affects both countries, but there's the very obvious border there. I'm wondering if you can just kind of maybe, Vicente, reflect on what this, collaboration with Mackenzie here on the north side of the border with your reporting, what have you learned from it and how does that kind of impact each of your own reporting, reporting on stories like this?
You are hitting a very important point because the problem is that we are sharing this problem, but we have very terrible communications. One of the first demands that the farmers are doing right now is, well, we want to find out, we want to talk to the U.S. authorities to see how are they distributing this money. So you have two different agencies that are affecting the way they work. The city affecting the citizens the way they are working, and we don't have enough communication. Looks like among these problems, we cannot solve these problems by or independently from the other ones. We share these natural resources, and we are using this very respectable but artificial boundaries that interfering with these resources that are the livelihood of this area of the country. We are sharing the mega drought too, and we need to find something that joins, takes in consideration the needs of the residents on both sides of the border.
And Mackenzie, I imagine this brings up a lot of challenges, though, with international law and, all this sort of things. How do you think about the collaboration you have here with Vicente?
Yeah, Vicente and I have been collaborating since 2020 when I first started at Voice of San Diego. I wanted to cover the Tijuana sewage crisis, and I was told right away by federal authorities that, well, you're a U.S. journalist, you talk to us, and then the Mexican journalists, they talk to the Mexican government. And I thought, well, that sounds dumb. How are we supposed to know what's going on both sides of the border? There's no... Vicente... I'm very grateful. He gave me his time and educated me a lot about this area. And we agreed to try to, through grants, we're able to do a lot of reporting on both sides of the border, publish our stories in newspapers in Tijuana in Spanish, and try to drive some of the conversation on that crisis. And then in our reporting, the sewage crisis is also points to and connects to the water scarcity problem. And so Vicente and I have started to sort of expand our collaboration to cover this Colorado River issue, which is really we're heading towards a very problematic year. We don't have any snowpack right now in the Rocky Mountains, which feeds the river. We're not expecting a huge, unless we have a miracle march of rain and snow. The river is headed towards serious crisis, probably before anyone's going to make any agreements on how to share the river. So we're going to see this pop back up again in the news, and we're going to be following it.
Vicente, what's next for your collaboration with Mackenzie here? What are you looking forward to covering?
Well, there's so many angles of the water crisis even though it's very different the way U.S. authorities or San Diego is dealing with their situation, and Tijuana is dealing with their own, and which is connected to not just Tijuana, but Mexicali, Playas de Rosarito. And we have so many businesses owned by American companies here that everybody is affected here. So we have to treat this situation as a whole region, and in the way we collaborate, Mackenzie has been very kind, but also we are learning a lot because it's very difficult, thanks to the collaboration with them, with her particularly, because you have to be very patient with so many technicalities and the problems with the translations to try to make it understandable, not just for the readers, but for us first. So we are trying to see what are the most pressing issues or the ones that are not well covered from this binational, bilingual perspective.
I've been speaking with Mackenzie Elmer. She is energy and environment reporter with Voice of San Diego, along with Vicente Calderon. He is the founder and editor of TijuanaPress.com. You can check out their full report, voiceofsandiego.org. It's also linked on our website at kpbs.org. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, we catch up with the hosts of the KPBS podcast, Port of Entry, and hear more about the cross-border stories they're telling. Roundtable returns after the break.
Watch programs on your schedule with the KPBS Plus streaming service. See new episodes of Nature and Nova, latest news from PBS NewsHour and KPBS Evening Edition, local shows like Ken Kramer's About San Diego. Learn more at kpbs.org/kpbsplus.
Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. With over 200 movies and more than 100 million views, the films of Emilio Montiel are in a genre of their own.
Exactamente. Los muertos no hablan. Pero prefiero muerto que regresar al presidio infernal.
Montiel has created a B-movie empire in Tijuana, built after years of hard work, resilience, and a never-say-die spirit. And he's the focus of the most recent episode from the KPBS podcast, Port of Entry. For well over 5 years now, Port of Entry has been telling often unexplored stories along the San Diego-Tijuana border. And I'm joined by the hosts of Port of Entry, Natalie Gonzalez-Rodriguez and Alan Lilly. Welcome to Roundtable.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for having
me. So great to have you both here. Alan, I just want to start with your latest episode here on Emilio Montiel. Tell us more about him and his work.
Emilio is quite a character, figuratively, literally. He's just a very inspiring man. He's older. I think he's 60-something. He's been making
71,
movies.
71, actually.
He's 71. Oh,
yes.
That's even wilder. Yeah, I mean, just his dedication to movies is really wild. And how much, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, just judgment he's faced for the kind of art he creates, because it technically is not... I mean, this is something we explore in the episode, you know, what is good art, because his movies are watched by millions and millions of people who really love what he does. So it begs the question, like, if people really like it and are moved by it, who are we to say that it's bad art?
And Natalie, you know, in this episode, you do explore your own feelings around it, and you admit you were a little hesitant to you know, go into this. Tell us more about why.
Yeah, well, I'm a theater actress.
Very serious theater actress.
I'm a very serious and professional theater actress. And I was very skeptical about this episode. Actually, the first time I watched some of the clips of his movies, my first thought was, wow, this is terrible. This is terrible. Like, how can people like this? But then when we met Emilio and we met some of the crew and actors of the movies, I realized that these films, they mean a lot to a lot of people, especially to his audience, to his Mexican audience that is living in the United States. It allows them to feel closer to home watching these movies. So I think it means a lot to them, and it's totally worth it that they're producing this type of movies.
A lot of the stories you highlight, you often talk with artists in the border region in Tijuana around the border, like Emilio, you know, and his drive here to make films no matter what, like no matter what hurdles are in front of him, which the episode just illustrates beautifully. And you yourselves are artists working here in Tijuana along the border. I'm just wondering, what makes this region a special place for creating art?
That's kind of like the thing I've dedicated my life to, speaking about that. There's many things, but to keep it brief, I think it's one of the most interesting places in the world, because anytime there's any kind of emergency in the world, some of that population ends up in Tijuana. So Tijuana has this very strange energy where people bring their dreams and desperations and hopes for the future in Tijuana, trying to get either somewhere else or just they stay in Tijuana. So as an art, people who are artists who are very sensitive to their environment, you absorb all that, and it creates, if you know how to direct that energy, it has a lot of its potency. And it's also like, you know, there's an extra added motivation of when, like Emilio's movies, where people are always judging the kind of art he makes, Tijuana also has lived a similar story where people are always judging what Tijuana produces because Tijuana has a pretty charged reputation. Mm. So I think it adds fuel to the fire of people that are creating in Tijuana to want to just keep going. And that is reflected in the art. You know, if you're making art somewhere, I don't know, like at Palm Springs, where there's none of that. You don't have to, you know, it's like if you go to the gym, the bigger the resistance, the bigger your muscles get. So when there's like all these external opinions telling you what you should be or what you are, it only adds strength to those that can withstand it.
Yeah, it's going to sound so cliche, but there's a lot of beauty in the darkness.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, your banter, your relationship, I can already hear it here just in being in the room with you. But it plays such an important role in Port of Entry, right? I mean, you guys are kind of finishing each other's sentences. You're guiding the listener through these stories you're telling. And I'm just wondering, you know, like how did you find that rapport? Did you know each other before? Where, you know, how did that develop for you?
We actually hate each other. We're not even friends.
We're acting right now.
We're acting.
You think she's a serious actress. I'm a super serious actor. Do you want to answer this?
I think you should start because we had an instant connection the first time we met on Zoom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Interviewing me, remember?
I mean, we were searching for a while, but like you know, life has a way of connecting you with like-minded souls in very strange ways. The first time Nat and I ever met in person, we were wearing nearly the exact same outfit, same color beanie, same colored shirt, and that's happened to us. I can't, dozens of times where we show up somewhere and we're like, what? You would think that we would have, someone would not believe us that we did not coordinate it, just how similar it was. And that just goes to show, you know, like destiny has a mysterious way of connecting you to people.
Also, we share the same humor, and I think that helps a lot, for sure.
I want to talk about that humor, because another piece of Port of Entry that's fairly unique, I mean, it makes sense for a border podcast, but you do episodes in Spanish and English. And I'm wondering how that process works for y'all. I mean, I think one thing about translation is it's a lot of times more of an art than a science, right? It's a difficult thing. How do you approach changing an episode from Spanish to English or vice versa, Natalie?
Well, our producer, Julio, and I, we translate the episodes together. And yes, sometimes it gets difficult because the subjects are saying something that there's just no way to translate it because it's just so powerful in Spanish to translate it from Spanish to English. But most of the people I'm going to dare to say that we interview, sometimes they prefer to do the interviews in Spanish. So it just makes our work easier for when we, you know, do the episodes in Spanish. Well, it's been a ride, but we wouldn't change it for anything because I think we have a lot of audience who are their first language is Spanish. And I'm going to dare to say that our episodes in Spanish are actually way funnier than the ones in English because we're just, I don't know how to say this, but Mexican humor is unique. There's nothing that compares to it. So the episodes in Spanish, if you speak the language and you listen to them, you're going to realize that we're way funnier in Spanish than we are in English.
Alan, do you agree?
Yeah, 100%. The Spanish language is just hilarious.
It is hilarious, yes.
Not that there's you can tell good jokes in English, but there's something about just going, you know, like it's our mother tongue, and a lot of these characters it's their mother tongue, so I was gonna make I know we're live, I won't make that joke. Let me sorry. Yeah, it's just there's a difference going straight to the source as opposed to putting like a mask on it. Not even a mask because it's still authentic, but you know, you have to, there's a layer of separation from what they're really trying to say when they're speaking a second language that is not straight from their heart.
Well, and that layer of separation, obviously, is like a metaphor for where this podcast is being produced. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, you are covering this single binational region we often hear about it, right, referred to, but they're two very distinct sides. And I'm wondering how you approach that in the stories you tell and when you, you know, think about covering on Port of Entry.
I think to me the most important thing is even though we are cognizant of that, is being that bridge and being that, like, finding the thread of similarity. Like, even though there are different languages and there are different differences in culture and cuisine and whatnot, there are, we also share a lot, and exposing that shared humanity is to me the point of this podcast, to kind of humanize and demystify what the other side is like. Because if you can do that, I think, I mean, the ripple effects of that are a net positive across the board for society when you stop, like, fearing the other side.
And I imagine, you know, obviously a lot of your episodes do just that. And I wanted to kind of gauge each of yours, maybe a few or one favorite episode that stands out to you during your time hosting the show. Natalie?
My favorite episode, I have a couple, but definitely the one that I treasure the most is, it's called Pura Vida, A Case for the Tijuana Dream. It's about a couple from El Salvador and Costa Rica, Ruby and Javier. They migrated to Tijuana with the purpose of staying in Tijuana, because you hear a lot of stories of people arriving in Tijuana because they want to cross the border to go to the States. But no, Javier and Ruby, they wanted to stay in Tijuana and live their own Tijuana dream. And that episode is my favorite because they opened the doors of their house and we sat down with them drinking coffee at their kitchen. And they opened up about some childhood trauma that they never talked about before with anyone. So it was a very cathartic experience, eye-opening, and we cried a lot. I cried a lot during that interview, actually, and we bonded for life, I think.
Well, we'll have a link to that episode. Again, it's called Pura Vida.
Pura Vida, Case for the Tijuana Dream.
Alan, what about you? What jumps out to you as, like, a memorable episode?
Yeah, I have. I mean, process-wise, my favorite ones are always the ones that we get to eat food, because there's a lot of really delicious food in this region. Like, we went to Cuscus, this place in Valle, with this Moroccan guy who has his restaurant there after having some challenges in San Diego, was able to make his dream come alive in Tijuana. Moomin, shout out Moomin. But I think my favorite story that we've ever told is a few years old. It was actually before even Nat was a co-host. It was Seth Sullivan, his nickname's Art Pusher, but he to me is he's just a contagiously joyful, positive human. But once you hear his story of how he ended up in Tijuana, his parents were like worked for the CIA, he has a really crazy story. I really recommend that episode called Hustle, Hustle, Hustle. But he so represents the eccentricness and the diversity of this region and what all the wild reasons how people end up here and make the best out of it and make art out of their circumstances, that I just always think of him when I think of this region and the beauty that it produces.
And you each, you know, now both of you live in Tijuana, but yes, you have, you know, different backgrounds, right? Alan, you spent time as a child, you know, childhood in San Diego. Natalie, you're Tijuanense through and through, right? Born in Tijuana.
Raised.
I'm just curious, you know, how has working on Port of Entry changed how you view this region?
I mean, I was born in Mexico City, funnily enough, and, like, I think Nat and I have bonded over this, but even, you know, like, my experience growing up from Mexico City to San Diego, Tijuana was just, like, somewhere that I just passed to get to Mexico City or to get to San Diego. And even when I decided, because I fell in love with Tijuana, decided to go move to Tijuana, for my parents, it was like, all the stigmas that you hear about Tijuana is like, why? I worked all this hard. I worked so hard to get you to America, and you're going back to Tijuana of all places. Even all the rest of Mexico. Not only is American media paint a negative picture of Tijuana, but a lot of Mexican people have a very negative view of Tijuana.
That is true.
So it's like, I mean, to me, I'm constantly having to defend or like sing the praises of Tijuana, not only to American people, to both sides of the border. And it makes me, you know, like, because that is the role that I chose in this life, it makes me, I don't know if it's changed my view of the region, but it's definitely has made my eyes for the things I appreciate about this region and the things that I can use as ammo to tell these people, like, no, this is why this place is great and has so much beauty and richness and warmth, it just made me more, I think, more sensitive to that.
I love that. I love that you mentioned that it's not only Americans, but also people who live in Tijuana that have a very negative perspective about Tijuana, because that was me for a long time, for all of my teenage years, at least. I was born and raised in Tijuana. I studied in Tijuana my whole life, been living there my whole life. But I started crossing the border to go to work when I was 18 years old. So I was studying college, and I was also working here in the States. And I actually had a very negative perspective about Tijuana, because my teenage years were during the presidency of Felipe Calderon, when the war on drugs was declared, and there were a lot of horrible things happening in Tijuana, mass shootings, a lot of terrible things that I don't want to talk about right now. So I did have a very negative view, because there were bad things happening. You know, it was not just the media. Like, I was a witness of those things. But then I realized that this is going to sound so dramatic and romantic, but that I am who I am because I grew up there, and I have this, I am the artist that I am, and I am the host and web producer that I am, because I got to see those two sides of this region, the Mexican side and the U.S. side. And ultimately, I think that's why I have a very open perspective of life. I don't know. That's just how I see it.
Oh, that's really well put. We'll have to leave it there. I've been speaking with Natalie Gonzalez-Rodriguez, along with Alan Lilly. They're the hosts of the KPBS podcast, Port of Entry. They're available wherever you listen to your podcasts. Nos vamos pronto.
Nos vemos pronto.
That'll do it for this week's Roundtable. Thanks so much for listening. Roundtable's technical producer is Brandon Trufa. The show is produced by Ashley Rush. Brooke Ruth is Roundtable's senior producer. And I'm your host, Andrew Bracken. Have a great weekend.
This year's GI Film Festival San Diego takes place May 6th through 8th and is sponsored by Creative Forces Community Engagement Grants, part of the National Endowment for the Arts Creative Forces Initiative in partnership with Mid-America Arts Alliance. Festival details at gifilmfestivalsd.org.